History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and then listen patiently enough for long-buried memories to take on some new meaning in the here and now. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. What a story we are in for today. Bridgeport, California has a posted population of 553. And the story of survival we're going to hear from 97-year-old Richard Burbine has enough mind-blowing material for all 553 and then some. He first served our country as a teenager, and 80 years later, he's still finding unique ways to serve. So I've interviewed quite a few guys who say, once a Marine, always a Marine, but I can't remember if I've ever met someone who was in the Merchant Marine before he became a Marine, and I want to take you back even further than that. Take me back to the very beginning, because you've got quite an interesting life's journey here.
Yeah. I started in 1926. My father was in World War I. He got mustard gas, and he died when I was 2 years old. My mother was a surgical nurse. She couldn't support us and work at the same time, so they sent us to Canada with my grandparents, Yarmouth, Nova Scotia. And I stayed there until 1938, when England and Canada went to war with the Germans. And I came back to the United States at that time. The first thing I wanted to do in 1942, when I was old enough, 16 years old, I joined the Merchant Marine. I tried to join the Marine Corps at that time, but I was colorblind, and they sent me down the hall, and they said, the Navy will take anybody. So consequently, I went in when I was 16 years old. I served all over the world in World War II, from the South Pacific to Japan to all the way to Russia and back. I was torpedoed on February 23rd, 1945, coming back from Murmansk, Russia. I am the last survivor of the last American ship sunk in World War II.
And we want to hear all about that. I'm interested, too, in your childhood, because you've told your story before. You've lived with it your whole life. It may not seem that significant. You just told us your father died when you were two, so you never really knew him. You're raised by your grandparents. Do you remember as a boy having some ideas of, hey, someday here's what I'm going to do with my life. This is what I want to be or what I want to do?
When I was in Canada, 90% of the people there were fishermen or sea captains. My granddad was a sea captain, and I became interested in going to sea at that time when I was a young child. And I always had fond memories because every time we went to the big city of Yarmouth, he took me down to the fishing schooners, and he knew all the fishing captains and all that. So it was instilled in me as a young child that the seaman life was the way to go, and consequently, I followed that idea.
And I know to live here in Bridgeport, California at 6,500 feet, you have to be able to tolerate some cold weather a little bit, but I want some perspective on this. Growing up in Nova Scotia, what kind of temperatures or conditions were you dealing with?
We dealt with snow 6 months of the year. Cold weather, 40 below zero at times. We had what you might call typhoon-type weather. Storms, rain, heavy snows, and blizzard conditions from days at a time. And consequently, I've grown up that way, and it didn't bother me. I'm here in Bridgeport now at 42, 45 below zero. It's another sunny day.
Well, and we're going to hear something maybe even more challenging than that by the time we're done. Another thing I'm interested in, and maybe there's something leading up to this, because you told us you wanted to sign up for the Marine Corps at 16, but you would have been, I guess, 15 when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. And most guys I talk to have some kind of memory of that day. Do you remember December 7th, 41?
My brother and I were in the movie theater when it was announced that Japan had attacked the United States. And as soon as we got out of the theater, we said, we're going to join. At that time, I was just coming under 16 years old. And I made a vow to myself that when I was 16 years old, I was going to go and fight those bastards. So consequently, my mother, I told her, whether you sign for me or not, I'm going to go. I'll get somebody to sign for me. And I did. So she volunteered to sign for me, and I went in to the Marine Corps, and they said, no, we can't use you because you're colorblind. But go down the hall. They'll be glad to get to the Navy. They'll be glad to get anybody. They're looking for bodies. And I did. I joined the Naval Reserve Merchant Marine, and that was in 1942.
Yeah, and as you said, you know, you went all over the world, and I want to hear about some of those adventures. But can you take us back to that 16-year-old kid and remember what your expectations were, what you really thought you were getting into?
My expectations were exactly what it turned out to be. I wanted to get in the fight as soon as possible, and I did. I went from boot camp right to the Pacific and went and joined a troop ship. We took troops to New Guinea, all through the Solomon Islands and New Guinea, made three landings in New Guinea. And then we came back to the United States. I joined a ship that was an ammunition ship. And we went to North Africa, and from there on out, all over the world. And consequently, ended up in Murmansk. First ship was the Sea Marlin. We transported Army troops to New Guinea and through the Solomon Islands. It's what they call the Bismarck Sea War.
And, you know, now with the lens of history, we know that being in the Merchant Marine was about the most dangerous thing you could do in World War II, as far as the casualties and the chances of survival. Did you have any idea about that risk that you were taking at the time?
I did, because I figured they won't take me in the Army or the Navy or the Marine Corps, and I wasn't about to go in the Army, that I would take the chances, and I did, and I survived.
And what were your duties aboard ship?
I was with the engine utility. We took care of all the pumps and the generators and the small machinery. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The boilers and all that. And when we come in port, we'd pull the headers off the boilers, lance the tubes, and put new gaskets in on the steam drums and all that. That was a part of our duty.
How'd you get along with the other guys on the ship?
Never had a problem. All the years I went, I never had a bad word or a problem with any of them. They were great people, and they all took the same chances as I did. We were all in the same boat, and that was it. Good people.
So you told us, you know, a cargo ship, and then an ammunition ship, and those two seem a little different. I mean, does it cross your mind that if you're on an ammunition ship and there's a submarine, that there could be a big boom somewhere?
The only thing that was a joke amongst ourselves, if we ever got hit, we'd never hear the explosion. It was that quick on an ammunition ship. So we took it for granted that, hey, if it happened, you'd never know it. And that's the way we all felt.
And for people who may not follow, you're saying the speed of sound isn't fast enough to catch up with what's already happened to you.
With the explosion, yeah. By the time you heard the explosion, you're gone. That would be the end of it. The lights were out.
And I understand. I mean, you can joke about some of these things now, but at the time, did you think you might not make it home, that you might not see your mother or your family again?
Never even crossed my mind. We took it for granted that we were there, and whatever happened, happened. And that's the way it was. You didn't dwell on things like that back in those days.
Well, and when you mentioned the troop ship, right, and taking all these young teenage faces just like yours and leaving them on beachheads, and you know what's going to happen to a lot of them. Was there some gravity to that? Did that weigh on you?
It was a thought that was behind your mind, really. You didn't dwell on it because you knew that it was going to happen, but you didn't know who it was going to happen to. And it was a known fact, and you just took it as a matter of policy or fact. Death was going to happen.
Well, and I know we're going to hear about February of 1945 and what happened, and people are going to be amazed that you survived that, let alone you're still going so strong now. But I'm just guessing that if you were in for that long a period, that there were probably some close calls or some hair-raising moments, some things that got your attention before the sinking of your ship in 45.
On several different convoys, ships would disappear from one area to another. The ships were in lanes, and every now and then you'd hear an explosion, you'd look in there, well, it was nothing but a cloud of smoke and dust, and that was the end of it. We couldn't stop because our orders were you don't stop, because you're in danger of the whole convoy when you do. But they had ships on the side, Navy ships, escorting us. They would stop and pick up the survivors or whatever who was left of the crews. And that happened on several times. But other than that, you didn't dwell on those things. You had a job to do, and you did it, and that was all there was to it.
And what can you tell us about the submarine threat, whether German or Japanese, and how big a presence that was in your thought process, your awareness, your consciousness?
We didn't think about it. If you thought about it, you'd go crazy. So it was a thought that you just put behind your mind, and you just dwelled on what you were doing and what was happening on the ship. And that's the way it was. You just didn't sit there and dwell on anything like that because you knew it was going to happen, but you didn't know when or where or who. And that's the way it was.
Did you ever hear from home?
Well, whenever we came back in port, we didn't get any mail or anything of that nature while we were at sea. They didn't even know where we were going, let alone where to send mail. So consequently, most of our mail was received on return to the United States.
So much has been written and told about World War II, but there are still areas of it that most people are not familiar with. I think if you ask the casual, you know, observer, they'll say, hey, there was the Pacific Theater and the Atlantic. They might not know about China, Burma, and India. And in this country, we don't know a whole lot about what was going on in Russia. But you mentioned Murmansk. What were you guys doing way up there?
Well, during World War II, you got to remember, the Russians were our allies. They were a strong ally because they took care of all that northern districts, which eliminated the American troops from even participating in there. Murmansk was really devastated. The Germans would come over there on a daily basis and strafe the whole harbor and everything in town. The people were absolutely destitute. What we did was every time the Germans would come over almost on a daily basis, on a time base, every ship in the harbor would open fire on them, strafe the whole area. So consequently, after the war, the Russians awarded us their highest medal for fighting and serving the motherland, which is unheard of here in the United States because most people never heard of it. There's two of us here in California, myself and another individual, and I can't think of his name, have the highest medal that the Russians gave to the American people, and it's right there, the medal of Ustyugov. And he was an admiral in the Russian Navy that never lost a battle. And consequently, after the war was over, they awarded us that medal for that reason, because we fought for the motherland.
I see it, yeah, and that's a first for me. I've interviewed over 1,000 guys from World War II, and I've never seen one of those in person, so this is exciting to see, and I want to hear the story. But before we hear about February 23rd, how long had you guys been operating in those waters?
Well, it wasn't so much operating in those waters. It was the fact that we went to Murmansk, and then from Murmansk we shuttled up to Archangel. And those were the only two ports in Russia that we went to. The reason for that was that they had the facilities in one port that was not available in the other for lifting off heavy equipment, locomotives. We had locomotives on deck, heavy ammunition. And that's why we went between the two, shuttle between the two ports. That was the only service we did while we were in Russia, was go from one port to the other and discharge our cargo, which was ammunition, locomotives, and tanks.
So you'd been in the tropical waters of the Pacific, where you're probably just walking around with no shirt and shorts, I'm guessing, right?
That's for sure, yeah. I went all through the Pacific area, from New Guinea down to the Solomons of the Philippines. Survived that. Another lucky break. It wasn't my time to go, and that's the way it was.
Were there some moments like that in the Pacific that almost got you?
There was a few, yes, in New Guinea and New Hebrides, all through that area. We got strafed by the Japanese. Consequently, we just survived, and it wasn't our time to go. And that's the way it was.
On a merchant ship, if you do find yourself under attack, was there something you were supposed to do in those moments?
Each and every one of us had a gun tub and a gun position that we were, and that's what we did. We either fired the weapons, and if the gun crew, Navy gun crew, any one of our people got killed, we took over for them, loading and firing the weapons.
And a lot of people don't understand this, that on these merchant ships, they had a whole lot of crewmen that were part of the merchant marine, but you also had Navy personnel on the same ship, as you said, doing the same job if you filled in, but were treated very, very differently by the government, weren't they?
They were treated as Navy personnel, which they were, and rightly so. They were gunners, and that's what their trade was, were gunners. We were seamen that operated the ship and not the guns. The only time we had anything to do with the weapons was our fire station. When we had a general alarm, we went to our firing station, which were gun tubs 1, 2, 3, or 4, whatever it might be. And you served as a loader. In the event the gunner got killed, you took over the weapon, loading and shooting the weapon. And that's the way it was.
But as I understand it, right, and I just want our listeners to understand, those Navy guys had full government benefits, full veteran status. You guys had none of that. You could be in the same battle. Navy guy gets wounded. He gets a Purple Heart. You get wounded. You get nothing.
That's true. That's absolutely true. In fact, after the war, almost 40 years after the war was over, I got my Mariner's Medal for being wounded during World War II.
But they've never given you the Purple Heart.
And they still will not give us a Purple Heart. Although they gave us veteran status, they will not give us a Purple Heart. The only thing that we have received from the American government was about 6 months ago. We were given the Congressional Gold Medal.
And I want to talk to you about that and what that meant. With respect to the Purple Heart, does that bother you at all that guys in your situation don't get what the other guys on the same ship or the same circumstances receive?
No, I was awarded the Mariner's Medal, which in our viewpoint is the same. It is the same as the Purple Heart. The only difference is the name. And I feel that the American government more or less gave us a slap in the face. They said we were willing to die for the country, but they weren't willing enough to give us a Purple Heart, which we earned.
And the Purple Heart comes with benefits for a lifetime through the VA, too. I know we're bouncing around here. The reason I brought up the weather in the Pacific and how hot in these tropical waters, and if you're down below by the boiler, I mean, you're probably 140 degrees, so you're out on the deck enjoying the sunshine. But to go from that to the waters off Murmansk, I mean, that's quite a contrast there.
Well, you'd be down in the fire room or engine room, which I was all the time. I spent all my time below the sea line. It was 130, 135, 140 degrees. And you come up on deck, and it was 20 below. It was an instantaneous freeze. It was just like somebody hit you with a belt. It was a shock to the body as soon as you stepped out onto the deck because it was so cold from that variation of heat and cold.
And I know how imaginative and ingenious young men can be. Were there some things that you guys on the crew came up with to mitigate those factors at all, to make it easier to deal with that transition?
No, that didn't happen. We were crew, and the officers made all the decisions as to what was going to be done and what was not going to be done. And they followed regulations strictly, and that's the way it was. We just did our job.
And I'm just, you know, just imagining, if it's that cold, nobody wants to end up in the water.
That's the last thing you want to do is end up in the water, because it was almost instantaneous freeze. You could be in the water for 4 to 5 minutes, and you were to the point where you were almost immobile from the cold. When we got torpedoed, I was in the water for 3.5, almost 4 hours. When they picked us up, I was the first one in the water and the last one to be picked up. The veins in our body were coming through the skin of the skin or flesh, like crystal bottles that froze, and it was crystallized all over our body. And the doctor, when he came aboard, said we had another minute or so, and we'd have absolutely froze to death. That's how close we were.
You know, I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you, but maybe we can hear about that day from start to finish. And as we lead up to it, let me ask you this. Before that day, before your ship was sunk, had there been other times where you guys had come under attack by German aircraft?
You got to remember, back in those days, from Norway to Russia was a daily operational for KG-26. They were from Germany into Norway. And when they captured Norway, they set up a base for convoy destroyers, and they flew from Norway to Murmansk back and forth. That was their steady patrol. So you were under that type of attacks every day, and the numbers were odd or even. It was either your time or it wasn't, and that's what happened.
And we're going to hear about that fateful day in the Barents Sea from start to finish when we come back. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for a short video with 97-year-old Dick Burbine of Bridgeport, California. And we'll be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend. It's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is. Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our chance to visit with 97-year-old Dick Burbine of Bridgeport, California, the last survivor from the last Allied ship sunk by the German Luftwaffe in World War II, the Liberty ship SS Henry Bacon, which was operating between Norway and Russia in the Barents Sea 78 years ago.
February 23, 1945, the ship was 60 miles from the normal convoy. We hit a severe storm that destroyed our steering mechanism. The rudder and the main springs from the hydraulics split and broke. My job was at the time was pick up that 150-pound spring, put it back on, try to hold it in place while they were navigating the ship. We were a hazard to the convoy, so we had to drop out of the convoy. We were by ourselves 60 miles away from the convoy. So if anything happened, they would get us, but they would not destroy the convoy. And that's what happened. KG-26 found us with 23 JU-88 torpedo bombers, one solid, solitary ship. It was touch and go. What they did was they flew left or port or starboard of the ship. One row would float down the left or the starboard or port side of the ship and strafe everything one way. The other one would come in the other direction and strafe the other way. So consequently, when they did torpedo us, they hit us in number 5 hole and blew the whole side of the ship out at that point. We were under general armor for that time, and everybody's at their battle stations and whatnot. So what happened was, after blowing a hole into the ship, we had a matter of minutes before the ship was going to sink. Because as the ship was going down, it was blowing the bulkheads out between the hatches and so on. I was ordered by the chief engineer, Donald Haviland, my chief engineer, he was a full commander, 3-striper, to get into the lifeboat. And the lifeboats were all shot to pieces, except for that one lifeboat was still in fairly good shape. It had a few holes in it, strafe holes in it, but it was still seaworthy. The other ones were just about shattered. So he ordered me in there to cut the lanyards because it was frozen to the davits of the lifeboat. You see what davits are? Mm-hmm. And the lines were frozen to it, so the lifeboat would not go down by itself mechanically. So I got in the lifeboat with a fire axe, and I chopped one line down, and the stern was okay. Just as I was cutting the bow of the lifeboat, a sea hit us, and the lifeboat and I went over the side. Well, when I came to, I was in the bow of the lifeboat. The lifeboat come down the back of my neck, and I still have that hump in my neck to this day. But anyway, I came to in the lifeboat, kicked my sea boots out, and I was able to right the lifeboat. The lifeboat was upside down. I was able to right it. And consequently, that's where they put all the Norwegian 19 women, 19 children, the list is up there, into the lifeboat. And they wanted me to get in. Well, I knew that was crazy. If I got in that lifeboat, I would freeze almost instantaneously because I was soaking wet. So I said, no, I will not get in the lifeboat, and I stayed in the water. I was able to get the life ring. And during all this commotion, one minute I'd be 60, 80 feet in the air on top of a wave, on the crest of a wave, and the wave would break and I'd be down 60 feet below the water line. And I saw 2 seamen, a friend of mine, and I was able to push the lifeboat, swim with the lifeboat over to him, and I was able to save both of them. One of his name was William Wildridge, and the other one was Woodrow Wilson Posen, and one Navy gunner by the name of Warren Batchelor. And I was able to save all 3 of them. So, and when they picked us up, they took them aboard. When they dropped me on the deck, my eyes opened. They said, my God, they're still alive. And that's how they knew we were all still alive.
I don't know if you can hear the sound, but I think the sound is everyone's collective minds being blown by this story because it just seems so remarkable, so impossible. I want people to understand one thing you said. You got the women and children in the lifeboat. They're okay in the lifeboat because they're not wet. But because you're soaking wet, you know, if I get up there, I'm just going to turn into a popsicle.
That's exactly true. They tried to get me aboard. They tried to, because when I righted the boat, they brought the children down into the boat, the women and children. And they tried to let me come aboard. And I said, told them no, for two reasons. One, the minute I'm in that cold air, I will freeze to death. And two, I'm taking place of two or three children. So consequently, I would not get in the lifeboat. And I did not. And it was almost, I would say, probably 73 or 4 years later, I was awarded the Norwegian full citizenship with ambassador privileges, and I was also awarded their Congressional Medal of Honor.
Well, I've got to say, I mean, that's what was coming to my mind, because I've interviewed several who've received our Medal of Honor in the U.S. and others who probably deserved it. But what you're talking about surpasses a lot of those Medal of Honor stories. How do you feel about it? I mean, you're telling us about this like it's no big deal. Do you realize how incredible or improbable or almost impossible what you did was?
I look at it. I was there at the time, and I did what I had to do. And that's the way it was. I still feel the same way today.
I think what all of us try to do when we hear a story like this is put ourselves in your shoes. Maybe you didn't have shoes on at this point, but...
I see boots on. Uh-huh. When I was under the lifeboat. That's because they were tied up in the bow of the lifeboat with all those lanyards and whatnot. So I kicked my sea boots off, and I was able to free myself. And when I did, I surfaced, seeing the circumstances. The lifeboats, the other lifeboats were all sunk. The women and children were trying to come down. They had no place to go. So it doubled my effort to right that lifeboat. And I did, and I was able to put all, they were able to survive. When we got to Scapa Flow, King Olaf V of Norway met us there. He tugged me so tight that he almost brought tears to my eyes, and he had tears running down his face in gratitude. He gave us at that time one of the highest medals that they'd ever awarded, and it was the Norwegian medal, war medal. And 68 years later, I was awarded the Norwegian Congressional Medal of Honor.
And I'm sorry for keep bringing you back here, but I want to understand what that was. This was really like. And I know it's 78 years ago, but we can tell your memory of it is still very clear. And 4.5 to 5 hours in the water, did that feel like an eternity? Was it going by quickly, slowly? What was it like in the midst of all of that chaos?
It was almost like a dead time zone, like your time stopped. To my knowledge, as my memory serves me right, I remember it was cold. I had a job to do, and I did it. And when they picked us up, they thought they were recovering bodies. That's how bad. I was on a life ring with three other people, Woodrow Wilson, Blackie Wieldridge, and Warren Batchelor, and myself. We were so low in the water, thank God, that the sea breeze would blow a crust of ice over us. We were in almost into a cocoon-type atmosphere. And that helped save our lives, because had we been exposed to that sea on a steady basis, we'd have probably all froze to death. But as it was, the ice sheltered us, and being the way from the shoulders down into the sea, our bodies were starting to crystallize. And when they brought us aboard, they thought they were bringing bodies aboard. Because of the ice on us, they dropped me, and my eyes rolled open. They said, "My God, they're still alive." And that's when they discovered the four of us were still alive.
It's one of those things, this has become a cliche, but I mean, if you wrote this script for a movie, no one would believe it, right? That's what this is. So what about you? You're a teenager. As you're in the water and your body is getting more and more frozen and time is going by, I mean, you have to start thinking you might not make it, right?
No, I never thought that.
Never.
I always thought I'm going to make it. I don't care what. I will survive. And when I spotted... One minute I'd be up there and I could see everything around me. The next minute I'd be down below the sea looking up a crest and you couldn't see anything. And I spotted these three different seamen that I told you about. And I was able to swim to each one of them with that life raft and save them. And when we got together and that ice cone froze over us, they thought they were picking up a life raft with four bodies. So, like I say, when they dropped me on the deck, my eyes opened and said, "They're still alive." They took us down to the mess deck, laid us on a table just like that, or their swinging tables. They went up to the officer's country and took bed sheets off the officer's beds, laid us on the table. They had to cut our clothes off, put the sheet over us, and they buried us in sea ice. They covered us completely with sea ice and let the body temperature melt the sea ice. It's the only way we'd survive because they had no medication at all except for Fuster's Royal Navy rum. And the doctor at that time was a hell of a nice young man. He told us he was a veterinary doctor before he served in the Royal Navy. And he says, I don't have any medication at all. We've picked up so many survivors. I'm completely out of medication. But I have all the Royal Navy rum you can handle. Are you willing? I said, hell yeah. And I've been drinking Royal Navy rum almost on a daily basis since then.
Well, it clearly saved your life. This is one of those where we need that disclaimer. You may not want to try this at home, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sorry that I keep bringing you back to things that maybe aren't as significant for you, but they're the questions that come up in our minds. As you're in the water for that long, hour after hour, clinging to these other guys, basically becoming a huddled mass of ice bobbing in the water, are you wondering, does anybody know we're here? Does anyone know we're alive? Are we ever going to get picked up?
The thought was, I hope we all get picked up, but it's not too likely, and I am not going to give up at all. I will never give up. So that's what was my thought was.
Were you even able to talk to each other, or was it too, yeah? What kind of things did you guys talk about?
We all mentioned the same thing. I hope we get picked up. Might not be likely, but we're going to survive. And our whole thought was survival. That was the most instantaneous thought in your mind at that time. I'm not going to give up. I'm going to survive, and I'll make it. And that's the way it was.
And I've talked to a lot of guys in situations like this. Not exactly like this. I don't know if I've ever heard one exactly like this. But where it was extremely desperate. They knew they couldn't save themselves. Someone or something was going to have to save them. And some guys say, well, you know, we prayed and we really believed God was on our side. Other guys didn't have that kind of belief. What was it like for you guys in those moments?
Well, I can't speak for anybody except for myself. And my thought was from the beginning, I'm too young to die. I'm not going to die. I'll not survive one way or the other. And that was my sole thought. I will not give up.
And we know those other three wouldn't have made it without you because you're the one that went and rounded them up and got them on the life ring. But have you ever wondered if you would have made it without them?
I didn't think about that at all. My thought at the time was, we're all together.
Yeah.
We're going to make it, regardless what. We are going to make it, and we did. That was my solid thought all the way through. I'm not going to give up, and I'm going to make it. And I've all felt that way all the way.
And were you fully conscious and everything when they took you out of the water?
I'll put it this way. I was semi-conscious. You knew what was happening, but you didn't really appreciate how it was being done. By that, I mean we were to the point where we were almost semi-conscious. And we could see what was developing, but we didn't seem to be able to react to it. And that was it until when they dropped me on the deck. It sort of woke me up out of a daze, and then I realized, hey, we are saved. And that's the way it was. And that's when they said, hey, these guys are alive. My eyes opened up.
How much of your body could you actually feel? How much did you actually have sensation in?
That I couldn't even tell you. I have no description on it, because at the time, it was almost like you were floating, looking into your body. There was no feeling numbness or cold or anything else. We were to the point where it was blackout time. That's how close it was. Yeah. And like the doctor said himself, he said another minute or so, I wouldn't have to worry about you people, because the ice crystals were coming through the veins, through the body.
So he asked you if you want the British Royal Navy rum. So what did that feel like as those first few drops start to go through your frozen body?
It almost felt like a blowtorch going through your system. I presumed that our body was so cold that the shock of this alcohol going through the body, it felt like almost like it was a low voltage charge going through your body. That's the way it felt.
What were the hours and days that followed like? What kinds of stages of recovery were you progressing through?
Well, we were, from the time they picked us up to the time we went to Reykjavik, they took a lot of the people to Reykjavik Island because they were to the point where they weren't going to save them. It was a matter of choice whether they took them onto the mainland of Reykjavik Island or not. I feel that had they not taken some of these people, that they would not have survived. because that's how far their body had deteriorated to the point where they just gave up. My personal experience was, I'm not going to give up, and I will not give up. And I didn't experience any of that. I just felt that it was a tingling, burning sensation as the feelings came back throughout your body. It was like you might put freeze your hands while you're fishing or something of that nature, and it's slowly starting to thaw out. You have that tingling sensation. That's the way we were throughout, or I was, throughout my whole body.
You mentioned helping the women and children onto the lifeboat. What were they doing on this merchant marine vessel?
We'll go back to the beginning. The island of Sorøya is a whaling station in Norway. They produced fine whale oil. The Germans wanted it so desperately that they occupied the island and the 500 occupants of the island, and they took them captive. What happened was, when the British Navy found out about this, they sent five British destroyers into Sorøya, and they evacuated all the ones that wanted to leave the island. A few of them wanted to stay behind because they didn't want the Germans to take over their property and whatnot, so they stayed on the island. But over 450 of them were evacuated on those five destroyers, and they took those people, men, women, and children, that wanted to go to Murmansk. Well, when they got to Murmansk, population was starving as it was. They had no place to put them, no food to give them. So they said, well, what are we going to do with these people? They decided to put as many on each ship that was in the harbor that could have support those people on each ship. We ended up with 19 women and children on the ship. Consequently, when we got torpedoed, they were the first ones to be evacuated, put into lifeboats. Norma Peterson up there was the two-year-old little girl at the time it happened. And she's now a grandmother in Norway. She would correspond with the Navy people that saved her. Uh-huh. And they would in turn tell me about her because they knew that she had been on our ship. And they would correspond with us and talk back and forth and with letters and whatnot.
It's time for our final break, but there's much more to come with 97-year-old Dick Burbine of Bridgeport, California. We'll hear about the man who saved his life 78 years ago and also some of his Marine Corps memories from the Korean War. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a story that is tough to wrap our brains around. Before I forget, I want to thank a generous pilot named Dwight Kroll, who flew me across the beautiful Sierra Nevada mountains to the little hamlet of Bridgeport, California. Quite a spectacular final approach coming in over the reservoir there, and Dwight handled it all perfectly. There were some breathtaking views, and then we both got to hear this jaw-dropping story of survival from Dick Burbine. And we're not done yet. Back to this 97-year-old veteran of three wars who we wouldn't have had the privilege of meeting if he hadn't survived against all odds that sinking of the SS Henry Bacon in the Barents Sea on February 23, 1945.
The individual that saved my life and the life of the three other people with me was a sub-lieutenant in the Royal Navy. He tied a heaving line around his waist, jumped into the sea, which is extraordinary. He did not have to do that. Went down, jumped into the sea, took one of us at a time, pulled us back up to the Jacob's ladder to the deck of the destroyer.
And he had to pull you because you couldn't pull yourself up.
We couldn't even help ourselves. We couldn't even loosen our hands from the fire, from the life ring. Mm-hmm. And he broke our hands loose from the ice, tied a heaving line around us to his body, and hauled us up to the deck of the ship. And his name was Ian Rodney Bowden. He was a sub-lieutenant at the time. He stayed in the Royal Navy after the war. He rose to be the commander of the Royal Navy yacht, one of the highest ranks in the Royal Navy. And he passed away a few years back. He did come to Tracy to see us. We had a good time, a few drinks, reminiscing. I've got some pictures of him up there if you're interested in that. One of the finest men I've ever met in my life.
You said you had a few drinks. Do I have to ask what you were drinking?
Royal Navy rum and coke. He blew his mind when he saw the Royal Navy rum. He said, there it is. In fact, I gave him a quart so he could take home with him, and he laughed about it all the way.
What did that mean to you to have that opportunity almost 60 years after the war to meet him and be able to thank him with the lens of all the things you've done since then?
I was able to thank the man personally, hug him, and thank him honestly. Saving my life, sincerely believing that had it not been for him, I would not be there to even welcome him home and thank him.
Yeah, and your son who's with you here in Bridgeport, he wouldn't be here either. There's a lot of things that would be a lot different. I'm wondering about the other part of that equation, because you shared how you helped the women and children into the lifeboat and then how you gathered up those three other guys in the water. I'm sure you had some encounters later on with some of those people. What kinds of things did they say to you?
The only one I ever encountered after that was I was able to sail with two of them. Woodrow Wilson Posen, I sailed with him after the war. And William Blackie Wildridge, I sailed with him after the war. They were both engine officers, same as I was. Woodrow Wilson Posen, the last I heard of him was he was working on the Seattle Space Needle when they built the Space Needle. Remember that? Mm-hmm. He was one of the heavy operators on that when he was on that. The last I heard of him, he passed away years ago. Blackie Wildridge, he lived about approximately 6 years after the war, and he passed away. He was a young man, too.
Well, and that brings up another question. I mean, when you go through as extreme of a situation as you survived 78 years ago, have there been lasting effects? Have there been things you've had to deal with because of what you went through that day that most of us wouldn't even think of?
Never. I don't dwell on it. I never even think of it unless something comes in the paper or that jogged my mind.
So you haven't had problems with your fingers or your toes or anything else?
Never had any problem of any type like that.
Just the lump on the back of your neck?
Well, it's not a lump so much as it is a concave. Uh-huh. With the lifeboat hit me in the back of the neck and it sort of concave my neck. But other than that, no. William Burr, I don't know if you heard of him or not. He was a young 18-year-old seaman at the time. 25 years later, they found his body on the shore of Norway, completely preserved, not a mark on him, frozen solid. And to this day, they put a monument at the exact spot that he was found. And his body was interred in Arlington National Cemetery.
I guess that's one thing we haven't had you tell us. How many people were on the ship? How many survived? How many didn't make it?
27 of the crew died, not counting the Navy gunners. And to this day, I don't know of any of them. In fact, I'm sure that I'm the last one that survived. Campbell, which was the radio operator, passed away about 4 years ago. And he was the last one that I communicated with at that time.
Well, and what about those who died that day? I'm sure you knew some of those people, right?
I knew the whole crew, every one of them. Like I say, I've never been able to communicate with any of their families or any of their relatives, so I don't know if any of them are still living or not.
Well, I bring that up because, you know, there were 406,000 Americans who gave their lives in World War II, and you came as close as anyone possibly could without being one of them, but here are dozens of your shipmates who made that ultimate sacrifice. What can you tell us about them? How should we remember them now?
I would remember each and every one of them as a friend, a loyal American, and a seaman to the day they died. They were just good, rugged seamen, and they did their job. They did it proudly, and they did it without any fanfare or any of that nature. That was part of that was their job. That's what they did, and they did it well. And I was proud to serve with each and every one of them.
And you've made it clear that your mindset was, I'm going to survive no matter what. And that got you through it. But when you tell someone this story and you see the look of disbelief on their face, or you even look back at it now at age 97 and try to figure out how in the world things happened the way they did, how do you explain it? How do you explain the impossible somehow being possible?
Well, since I was old enough to even reason, I have always believed two things. One, you are born on a certain date, and two, you're going to die on a certain date, regardless what or how or when. When your time is up, your time is up. If it's not, you're going to live it through like it wasn't even there. And I'm a firm believer, and I still believe that.
Well, and that's why you're still so active volunteering for the Forest Service and all the other things you're doing. This is your 36th year volunteering for the Forest Service. What do you do for the Forest Service?
My son and I, we do all the campground maintenance for down dead hazardous trees so that nobody can get in there, a tree fall on them or shatters or anything of that nature. We just cut them out and take them out. And we do not sell the wood. We keep the wood for our own service, or we give it to the local people here in Bridgeport that need it. There's five different people that we have given wood to year after year because they can't afford to pay $480 a cord for wood. They're widow women and so on, men that are crippled and can't do that themselves. So that's what we do.
Do you know any other 97-year-olds who are out there with chainsaws chopping up big old redwoods?
You put me in a spot. No, I don't. I don't know anybody at that age that are still doing that. In fact, all the people that I have worked with through the years are all passed away, and they were all good, hard-working woodsmen.
Why do you still do it?
A love of nature, and I enjoy working. Working is my pride and joy, and I've always been that way.
And there's a little bit of irony here, because by all probability, you shouldn't have any of your fingers and toes, right? I mean, wouldn't that be the reasonable expectation that if you were in the water that long, you wouldn't have any of your extremities?
That's true. Usually there's amputation because of dead tissue and whatnot. They have to amputate and whatnot. I've been fortunate and I haven't lost anything, and I feel very fortunate.
And the only reason I bring it up, and I'm needling you a little bit here, is you've got your index finger wrapped up because a wood splitter did something 5 hours in the frozen water couldn't do to you, huh?
That's about the size of it. With a pair of gloves on, it pulled my finger right into the splitter, and it peeled it right down to the bone.
What are you made of, Dick? Can you tell us? Can you give us a secret?
Well, I'll say we're made out of a good Irish and Canadian Canuck Indian blood, and I think it's some of the finest blood in the world, especially the Irish blood. We take a toast, but never go too far.
Mixed with a little bit of British Royal Navy rum, huh?
Absolutely. It goes a long way. And that's the finest drink I've ever had in my life, and I've traveled all over the world. And I have never had a better drink than the Royal Navy rum.
Well, and I mean, I really could sit here for hours in every corner of your walls in here. Did you do the woodwork in here, by the way?
Yes, I did. I did all the woodwork. Joe and I did this ourselves.
I had a feeling.
Something I'd like to tell you, though, that you might not have ever heard before. I wear a hat with three war veteran on it. A lot of people ask me, well, when were you in Vietnam and what did you do? I said, I was in Vietnam 5 years before Vietnam was Vietnam. And they look at me and say, what the hell are you talking about? I says, I was in Vietnam when Vietnam was French Indochina. I was fortunate enough to go to Sidi Bel Abbes, North Africa. We picked up the 13th Demi Brigade of the French Foreign Legion. Before they came aboard, they welded an 8-foot cyclone fence completely around the ship. And I said, what the hell going on? And they said, you'll find out in a minute. The 13th Demi Brigade of the French Foreign Legion come aboard. We went through the Suez Canal. Gun ports on each side of the ship. If any French Foreign Legion went over, that's what that 8-foot fence was, desertion. They shoot them on the spot before they even got off the fence. We went through the Suez Canal. We took them to French Indochina, A Dock. They went in from the beach, from A Dock to Bien Bien Phu. Bien Bien Phu is a bowl. They died to the man, including the colonel. That's the God's honest truth. That's how I became acquainted with Vietnam.
Well, and I was going to ask you about what happened in between, because I mentioned when we first started that, you know, once a Marine, always a Marine. But before you were a Marine, you're in the Merchant Marine. And I see your 1st Marine Division patches over there. And I see a helicopter. And it says Korea, 1950, 1954. But I got to ask you what may sound like a dumb question to you. If you should have died in World War II, and it's a miracle you survived, why in the world did you join the Marine Corps after that?
This is my country, and I die for it. And that's what I did. I went in. In fact, I was in Korea when the Korean War started. I was in Busan when the Korean War started. We come back from Korea to the United States is when I went and joined the Marine Corps. This time, no qualms about being blind or anything else. The Marine Corps needed some gunfighter, and I went in the Marine Corps. And I was lucky enough to go back to Korea, and I was with VMO-6, the 1st Combat Helicopter Group in the Marine Corps. We saved 8,000 Class A evacs that would have died if we had not picked them up out of the lines. And I'm really proud and pleased about that. And I'd do it all over again.
Well, I'd love to hear more about it because, you know, the Korean War, as you know, as well as anybody, has so often been called the Forgotten War. Most people on the street couldn't tell you what was happening, why we were there, or why it still matters today. And you're there from the very beginning. You're there still in the Merchant Marine when it started? Is that what you're saying?
The Merchant Marine when it started. And I came back to the United States, joined the Marine Corps, went through boot camp, and from boot camp right overseas.
And so VMO-6, as you said, the 1st Marine Combat Helicopter Unit, what was your role? What were you doing?
Crew chief with the helicopters. And like I say, we saved 8,000 Class A evacs. And I have a picture, a United States Marine Corps picture over there that I can show you. A Peiping missile. You ever hear of a Peiping missile?
Let's hear about it.
Peiping missile is a Chinese duck. Flew right through our cockpit and blew the cockpit out over the Hum River. And we call it the Peiping duck missile. Yeah. And I kept that duck for almost a year in my hooch in Korea. And just about a week before I came back to this country, somebody killed it and ate it. And if I'd have caught him, I'd have killed him. I'd have firmly killed him because that was my favorite animal.
So I'm going to put this picture up at hometownheroesradio.com. So this is a photo of you standing next to the helicopter, and there's a hole in the canopy, and there's a little duck in your hand like he's your pet.
And I kept him for a year after that, and somebody put him in the pot just before I came home.
And again, since so many people know so little about the Korean War in general, and specifically about what you were doing in VMO-6, when you say 8,000, that's a big number, especially since this is just a few at a time. So you say crew chief. That's a lot of different responsibilities. Give us a taste of what some of the things you were doing were on a daily basis.
On our daily basis, we were repairing rotors, engines, replacing engines, or whatever that might be. Anything wrong with the helicopter, our responsibility was to service it and have it flyable.
And how would one of these evacuations work? Can you give us an example maybe of one of them that was memorable?
Well, to bring you back to in place, the high mountains in Korea were phenomenal. The aircraft that we were flying, Franklin engines, were not strong enough to support the aircraft and gain altitude or build a cushion under them. The engine was not strong enough for the weight of the aircraft and the evac. We've been on some mountains in Korea where we put the two evacs on the line, had to actually push the aircraft off so it would get a cushion so it could take off. And I mean, with the evacs in place, actually get on the side of the chopper, one on each side, and push it off the mountain so that it would drop down and finally build a cushion so it could fly away. That's the God's honest truth.
So yet again, this is a pretty dangerous duty where a lot can go wrong, a lot can kill you.
I'll put it this way. Death is your neighbor. It's there with you constantly, and you know it, but you ignore it because it would drive you crazy if you just accepted it.
And you spent quite a long time over there, huh?
36 months. I volunteered to stay over twice, and on the third time, which was a year at a time of voluntary stay, I stayed twice, did my first hitch, did two extensions, and the commandant in the Marine Corps said, send him back to the States, he's going Asiatic. So I came back to the States. They wouldn't let me stay for the third tour.
And some people may not be familiar with that term, he's going Asiatic. He's basically saying, you're losing your marbles, you can't think straight. Was he just saying that because you'd have to be crazy to want to stay there that long?
They figured that you were going psycho if you were staying there that long, because most people would stay there one, two tours and go. I made two tours plus my normal.
And I'm just guessing there were some other things that happened during 3 years there that probably stand out to you. And it probably got close to as cold there as you did in the water off Norway, huh?
Yeah, it was an accepted fact. I mean, you were in a combat zone and you did exactly what had to be done at the time. And you didn't stop to think of a good, bad, or indifferent. You did it because that was your duty and that's what you were there for. And that's the way it was.
Again, I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you. But one thing I really don't want to forget to say is thank you. Thank you for serving our country in so many different ways. You're still serving your community and so many people who don't even know what you're doing. And thank you for telling us a story nobody else could tell us. I want to ask you a couple more questions, and then if there's anything else you'd like to add, feel free. One, if you think back over 97 years, is there something you'd say that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
For living that long.
And you're still living. You're not coasting. You're not easing in to the end here.
I don't believe in being idle. I was born a worker, and I was remain a worker till the day they bury me. I like to work, and I use my hands, and it keeps my body fit. It's some of the best medicine in the world is to keep busy. That's what my firm belief.
And because of that, because you're so active and engaged and forward-thinking, I'm wondering if there's something that's on your list that you haven't checked off yet. Is there something you're still looking forward to, still hoping to do or experience or accomplish that hasn't come to fruition yet?
I often wish, especially when I get up in the morning, I'm full of piss and vinegar. I often wish that I was younger again where I could do it all over again. And I would. I'd serve my country all over again the same way.
Even February 23rd, 1945?
Even February 23rd, 1945. If I had to do it all over again, I would voluntarily do it for my country. And I am proud of this country, and I love this country, and I'll die for this country if I have to.
And I don't think anyone's arguing with you. And, you know, you've mentioned a few different medals through the course of our conversation, the government of Norway, the government of Russia, and then our government, just in the last year, finally caught up. And they said, anybody who served in the Merchant Marine, you're getting the Congressional Gold Medal. What did that mean to you?
It means that finally the government is recognizing what service you have done for the country. To this day, they still will not honor the Purple Heart. Why, I don't know. Why would they give you one Purple Heart for one part of the service and a different one for another part of the service? You're serving the same country. It should all be the same. And I feel strongly about that. And that's all I have to say about it.
Dick Burbine, 97 years young. I don't think there's much more to be said. Although, we did have a little more with Mr. Burbine that wouldn't fit into our radio time. You can find that, as well as some thoughts from his son, in the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we'll be reminded once again, as we were so powerfully by Dick Burbine's incredible story of survival today, that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
As promised, here's Dick's son, Joe. Joe, when did you start to figure out that your very existence was pretty miraculous because of what your father had been through?
Probably by the time I was about 6 or 7 years old and I started understanding the story. Didn't really talk about it too much in the younger days. As I was growing up, I'm looking at the few medals that he had at the time, the government had issued at that point. This is back in the 1970s. And so I started asking questions and he started talking a little bit more about it. And then by the 1980s, when Reagan finally said, these guys are actually veterans, the government at that point started issuing the medals that they should have had during the war.
What's the most remarkable element of all of it to you?
The most remarkable element, I think, is the survival of going through it, and the sacrifice that the crew made, not only my dad, but the ones that didn't make it. The captain of the ship and his boss, Chief Haviland, they gave up their seats. It's hard for me to talk about it. But they gave up their seats for 18-year-olds to sit in a lifeboat. And for all the civilians, you know, the sacrifice that those guys made, that's amazing.
It sure feels like one of those stories everybody should know, doesn't it?
Well, it has been talked about a little bit. There have been films made back in 2002, I believe it was, There was a Scottish filmmaker that did a little short story that included the Henry Bacon. There's been a book that was written about it roughly about the same time period called The Last Voyage of the SS Henry Bacon. So it's been partly covered, and hopefully more people will hear about it eventually.
Have you seen your dad slow down at all?
Very little. I mean, he's still a pretty active guy, but no, he's tough character. I mean, they talked about the old days of wooden ships and iron men. Well, he was on a steel ship, and he was still an iron man.
And you were saying you've had contact with other people connected to the Henry Bacon. What are some of the things that you've learned or that have been meaningful to you through that?
Well, the biggest thing that I've done, again, this is through Facebook. I don't know if you can advertise that or not, but I've made contact with some of the children of these guys that were on the ship. And in some cases, they were nieces and nephews of people that had been on the ship. And some of them really didn't have a clear understanding of what had taken place. They had heard stories from their parents who were siblings of these guys. And so they understood parts of it, but they didn't have a real clear understanding. And so through me, I guess what's happened is, in a lot of cases, they would ask questions and ask my dad if he could remember certain members of the crew. And he did, for the most part. And so he could tell them a little bit about their relative that is no longer here to tell the story themselves. And then as far as the Norwegian survivors, I was in communication with three of them. They were kids at the time that this took place. One of them, Sophie Peters, was just a baby. She has no memory of it at all. But two of the older boys were, I believe, 8 years old and 6 years old at the time. One of them has since passed on. But they had full memory of what took place. They saw everything that went on. And so about 3 years ago, we had custom caps made of the SS Henry Bacon, and we got their addresses and mailed them caps. So they have some memento of that day and to go along with their memories of what had taken place. So it's been kind of interesting.
And if there's anything else that you want to share, feel free. But, you know, I'm wondering, for you, if you can explain your dad to someone who hasn't met him. People are hearing his voice on the radio, they're getting a feel. But what do you most appreciate about who he is?
Probably his inner strength. I mean, when it comes to religion, he doesn't really express a whole lot of it. He grew up Catholic, and he's been an altar boy of all things, which if you know him, you'd kind of wonder how that happened. But he's got a strong inner sense of spirit. And strength, inner strength. And as he said, he never gives up. And when he sets his mind to something, he'll see it through. He'll make sure it happens. And so he never gave up. And just his sense of always trying to help. We've got people around town, he mentioned about the wood cutting. They can't physically do it themselves, or they can't afford to buy the wood. So he'll go out of his way to make sure that they get through the winters. And this particular year, we actually ran out of wood because we were giving wood, our wood, away. But that's just how he is. He's a very giving person, very strong person, inner spirit, strong. I think that's kind of, I don't know how to really describe it. It's just one of those kind of things that if you've ever met him, you're impressed by him. He looks much younger than he is. We would go to the VA together because we're both veterans. And you'd see some of these guys walking in there, and they're talking about their sad stories of how crippled up they are and everything else, and then you find out they're 20 years younger than my dad is, and they just kind of clam up. And I'm not taking away from what they did, because I'm sure they served honorably as well, but they have no clue who they're talking with or what their background is, and then when they do hear it, they're kind of in awe themselves. So it's been kind of interesting to see.
And I'm just going to guess, as a boy growing up, you probably couldn't get away with complaining about much, given what your dad had been through and the perspective he had.
Well, I don't think I've ever been one really much for complaining anyway. And if I did, you pretty much get shut down pretty quick. But yeah, it's just, we take life as it comes. I mean, you're basically given a deck of cards, if you will, and you play the card you're dealt. And for better or worse, you have to make the best of it. I'm very proud of him, and I hope I can be at least half the man he is.